From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The last months of the Bush administration and global warming. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush barely showed up for this week's UN session on global warming, but he's conceded that human activities do contribute to climate change. Today, the White House begins its own conference with 16 countries responsible for 90% of greenhouse gas emissions, including China, India, Brazil, and South Africa, along with the industrialized Western world. On To the Point, will it undermine or complement the United Nations? Is the international community taking it seriously? On Reporter's Notebook later on in Los Angeles, another celebrity murder trial ends without a conviction. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. President Bush came late to the conclusion that industrial activity causes climate change, but today he begins his own conference on global warming. On To the Point, is he trying to bolster the United Nations or circumvent it? Does he still have time in his presidency to make a difference? On Reporter's Notebook, O.J. Simpson, Robert Blake, now Phil Spector, Los Angeles celebrities charged with murder but not convicted. What does big money have to do with it? First, this news update. Contraband, including radioactive material, could easily be smuggled across the Canadian border. That's according to the Government Accountability Office, the investigative arm of the Congress. It reported today to the Senate Finance Committee. Chris Strom was there for Congress Daily. That's a Capitol Hill news service of the National Journal Group. Chris, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Did this come as a big surprise?
Well, the big surprise with this latest report is that GAO investigators were able to go up to the northern border and find large open areas where they were able to cross without being detected. Previously, they had gone through ports of entry, which were actually staffed, and they were able to smuggle radiological material over. The difference with this new report is that GAO showed that how easy it would be for somebody to come across the border undetected and carrying contraband or radiological material, and it elicited a lot of frustration, a lot of outrage from members of the Senate today.
Did they actually, the GAO investigators, carry radioactive material across the border?
They didn't actually carry the material. What they did was they carried bags across that they could have stuffed with contraband or radiological material. What they found was that there were areas where there was no detection devices whatsoever, no radiological detection devices, areas where there was apparently no cameras, no sensors. What they were trying to simulate is that somebody could stuff a bag full of illegal contraband and bring it across the border without being detected.
You said the senators were stunned and outraged. That's a very long border, is it not? Has anybody ever claimed that the entire thing was impervious to smugglers?
No. The issue becomes the level of attention and resources that have been put down on the southern border. Senators were saying that they feel that there's an imbalance here along the northern border. Homeland Security officials testified today, and under some pretty direct questioning, they disclosed that there are about 250 Border Patrol agents on duty at any time for the northern border, and the northern border is about 5,000 miles long. So senators were trying to draw out the point that so much attention has been put on the southern border to the neglect of the northern border.
How many agents would it take to patrol or secure 5,000 miles of border?
Well, that's the big question that nobody is able to answer right now. The Border Patrol says that they are working on an estimate in terms of how many more agents they're actually going to need. They were fully in agreement that there's holes along the northern border and they don't have it fully secured. Their senators were directly questioning how much more is going to be needed, not only in terms of personnel, but also in terms of technology, whether it's sensors or unmanned aerial vehicles. And there were some points during the hearing today when senators said they didn't feel that Homeland Security officials were being candid, were being honest in their responses. They felt that Homeland Security was being vague and evasive in response to the questions. Homeland Security, for their part, say that they're doing what they can with the resources they have.
Some years ago, a man who intended to bomb the Los Angeles International Airport was intercepted coming across the Canadian border. I don't think he was out there in the middle. I think he was at one of the major crossing points. But did the Customs and Border Patrol or Border Protection Agency of Homeland Security say that they've had any successes? They've been able to apprehend anybody coming across?
Oh, yeah, sure. They provided GAO a list of successes that they've had. And there's no doubt that they have had successes, both at the ports of entry and in the areas that are between the ports of entry. The issue becomes, should they be doing more? What's it going to take to be able to do more? There's money that's in hold right now in the next Homeland Security Appropriations Bill. That's caught up in the Congress right now. There's been a lot of talk about the need to provide more personnel, more money for technology and resources to the border, and that's kind of what everybody's grappling with right now.
So again, money caught up in the whole logjam over appropriations. The Congress is way behind in terms of getting spending and appropriation bills passed. That's one of the things we're going to be seeing over the next few days or perhaps even weeks. Chris Strom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, with Congress Daily, that's a Capitol Hill news service of the National Journal Group. In a moment, the last months of the Bush administration and global warming on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. It wasn't until late last year that President Bush agreed publicly that industrial pollution is a cause of global warming. He barely showed up at this week's United Nations Conference on Climate Change, but today in Washington, he has begun a conference of his own. He'll be there tomorrow. Today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice opened the meeting of the world's 16 top polluting nations. They include not just the U.S. and the Western industrial nations, but Brazil, South Africa, and most importantly, China and India. Juliet Eilprin is an environmental reporter for The Washington Post. And Juliet, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
What did Secretary Rice have to say today?
Well, she said, again, some of the things you alluded to, she argued that while global warming was a global problem, the fact is that humans are contributing to the problem and the U.S. specifically is contributing to the problem, and that President Bush is committed to having a broad engagement with other nations in order to come up with some solution. She really emphasized the development of technology to address this problem, because she talked about how while it's important to save the planet, you don't want to do that at the expense of growing economies. And so that was one of her main messages this morning.
Is that something that's directed specifically at China and India, growing economies that weren't required under the Kyoto protocols, for example, to reduce emissions, at least by the same proportion as other nations?
Absolutely. That was part of what she was saying, the idea that they're emerging economies that you don't want to stifle, even as you're imposing environmental controls, although obviously she's also alluding to the U.S. and developed countries. And that is something that, for example, the Bush administration has consistently invoked when saying that it opposes a nationwide, economy-wide mandatory cap on carbon, that you don't want to do that because it has such economic costs.
Now, the United Nations, or at the United Nations Conference on global warming, which I gather will meet again in Bali later
right.
this fall, there were 80 heads of state or something along that number present. What about this conference? Have heads of state appeared here?
You're exactly right. There were at least 80 heads of state on Monday at the UN, and there's exactly one head of state at this conference, which is Bush. And so that is certainly something that a number of delegates have mentioned to me in saying that this is not, while it's being called a summit, a lot of the delegates say the real summit was in the UN in preparation for these December talks in Bali.
Are there those who think that you mentioned the opposition of the Bush administration to mandatory controls, that what's really happening here is that the Bush administration is trying in some way to circumvent the United Nations?
That's come up as an initial concern among some delegates, but I think that the administration has been fairly clear that they argue what they are doing will be considered within the UN context. So I don't really think that that's as much of a legitimate critique of what the administration is doing than maybe some other things people are saying.
How seriously are the people who think about these issues taking this meeting at the White House?
Not terribly seriously, I would say. One of the delegates said to me and my co-writer Steve Muffson in a story we published today that essentially one of the reasons delegates were coming here was just to make sure that the U.S. didn't undermine the U.N. process on global warming. And so I think that a lot of people are coming here as a precautionary measure, obviously as a diplomatic measure. You never turn down the President of the United States when that person invites you to Washington to discuss climate change. But no one's really expecting a significant immediate result from this meeting. And even White House officials are emphasizing that there will not be some earth-shattering announcement that will come out tomorrow on climate change.
Again, Juliet Alperin is national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. David Montgomery is vice president in charge of the environment practice at CRA International. That's a global business, economics, and finance consulting firm. And, Mr. Montgomery, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Do you think that this ought to be taken seriously, that there will be something significant coming out of it?
I definitely think that these meetings should be taken seriously because I see essentially no prospect for progress internationally on climate change unless the negotiations are limited to a group like this. It just strikes me as being absolutely futile to think that the 200 countries who have to participate in UN negotiations about climate change, most of whom have primary agendas that have nothing to do with climate change, are ever going to come up with an effective agreement that effectively brings developing countries into doing some sort of action. So I think this is really the only approach that's going to work, but it's going to be a long, slow road because it's going to be a long, slow process of finding ways of reaching an agreement that reconciles the desires of those developing countries for economic growth and cleaner technologies in the process.
Now, there are 16 of the major polluters here in Washington, accounting for something like 200% of the total. What do you mean when you say that the other nations that would be participating at the UN have agendas that don't have anything to do with climate change? Would they be expected then in some way to resist the imposition of mandatory controls?
Well, I think most of them have quite consistently and uniformly resisted mandatory controls. The countries that have signed up for the mandatory controls are the industrial countries, the vast majority of the countries who are in those negotiations have made quite clear that they are not interested in signing up for mandatory controls at all. I think that's the biggest problem, that we don't in fact have much prospect of getting an agreement on mandatory controls that will be global, but we do, I think, have some serious prospects of getting agreement to start taking actions and moving in the correct direction if the negotiations stick with these, say, 15 to 20 countries that are responsible for 90% of the world's CO2 emissions.
So do you, David Montgomery, look forward with any optimism at all then to the Bali conference, which will involve a lot more countries, I gather, later this fall?
No. I think that the prospects for I think that at this point the Kyoto Protocol has pretty much proved itself not to be a framework in which we can get an enforceable international agreement because there are essentially no penalties for a country deciding not to join and no penalties for a country withdrawing if they decide they don't like the targets that they signed up for initially. So we really don't have a mandatory agreement, and I see little prospect that any of those 80 countries are going to adhere to one at any point in the foreseeable future.
David Montgomery, again, with CRA International, a global business, economics, and finance consulting firm. Juliet Eilprin, back to you with the National Environmental Reporter with the Washington Post. What's the response that you hear to that from people who have more faith in the United Nations process?
Oh, well, obviously the response you hear from folks is that, you know, the UN is the best form for this. Ban Ki-moon, the new Secretary General, has made this one of his top priorities. And I think a lot of people think there's actually momentum in the UN process. I've been to these negotiations before, and certainly a couple years ago, people were questioning how effective they were going to be. I think a lot of people feel like there's momentum going into Bali and that you could have a meaningful agreement. Both, but really what you'd be talking about is a mandate for future negotiations, but there's a sense that, because first of all, other countries are being much more aggressive in talking about this, again, in our discussions that I'm having with them, than they were even 6 months ago. I think that there's a sense that you could have talks leading to a meaningful agreement.
So, Mr. Montgomery, you don't buy that. No changes taking place, no prospect for a consensus amongst most of the nations?
Well, I'm not sure whether we agree or disagree about what a meaningful agreement is. I think that given the amount of investment that many countries have made in the Kyoto Protocol, the administration is right to point to these meetings in Washington as being supportive of the Kyoto Protocol. But if we're going to see something meaningful come out of the framework convention negotiations, I think it's going to have to involve future agreements moving much more toward the kind of parallel development of policies and measures among different countries where they move together but in a parallel fashion, rather than trying to construct one overarching agreement for a system of mandatory targets involving every country in the world with an emission trading system that makes it all work out right. I can't see ever getting to that under the Kyoto Protocol, but if what we mean by a meaningful agreement is one which moves away from that targets and timetables framework, more toward pledge and review focused on policies and measures, to use some of the buzzwords, then if the framework convention negotiations move in that direction, then I think they do have a prospect of a meaningful agreement. And I see the example of the Asia-Pacific Partnership and the kind of discussions that are occurring now in the major emitters as being a necessary step if that's going to happen under the Kyoto framework as well.
President Bush, of course, pulled the United States out of the Kyoto framework. Is, Mr. Montgomery, the major distinction here between voluntary and mandatory change?
Absolutely not. No international agreement on climate is in any sense mandatory because no country is going to adhere to an international agreement unless it's in its own national interest to do so. So all international agreements are voluntary. The only question is whether they contain incentives to make countries want to stick with their commitments and move forward, or whether they're essentially unenforceable. I think I and a lot of other experts in fields of international relations who've studied this much longer than I have simply concluded that the Kyoto framework is unenforceable and therefore ultimately unstable and incapable of producing big and costly emission reductions.
David Montgomery again, CRA International. Annie Petzonk is International Counsel at Environmental Defense. She's also adjunct professor at the George Washington Law School and previously served in the administrations of both the first President Bush and Bill Clinton. She's also been with the United Nations Environment Program. Annie Petzonk, welcome to you.
Thank you.
David Montgomery is obviously not bullish on the United Nations. What can you say in response to what he just said, that you can't have mandatory controls because it's not in because no nation will agree to anything that's not in its own interests? They have to be voluntary, and that the only way to get consensus is to have fewer rather than a larger number of nations at the table.
Well, David's right on one point, which is the fundamental challenge of international law is to develop legal frameworks that sovereign nations will want to participate in. David may have missed it, but last week in Montreal, over 100 nations agreed to strengthen the mandatory caps on pollution under the Montreal Protocol on the ozone layer. That's an agreement that was negotiated by Secretary of State George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State in the Reagan administration. And that agreement has mandatory caps on ozone-depleting pollutants that apply to both industrialized and developing countries. But the other, there are two other major factors here that are worth taking a look at, Warren, and one of those is that the Kyoto Protocol has established an international emissions trading market in which nations that have caps on emissions but that reduce their emissions below their caps can sell some surplus emissions allowances to others and also can invest in emission reduction projects all over the world. And that market has gone from $0 to $30 billion in a matter of a couple of years. It's growing rapidly. And what's key is that developing countries increasingly are signaling they want to be part of that market. The second major development is that we're not dealing just with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the central treaty negotiation process here. Other countries are beginning to understand that when America signs up to a treaty, it requires not only action of the president, but also action of the Congress. And there are a number of bills pending now in Congress and proposed bills in the works that would cap America's greenhouse gas emissions and set up a vibrant emissions trading market here. Many experts think that would be one of the largest new markets in anything to arise in recent years. We already have such a market that's working very well, as David knows, for capping sulfur dioxide or acid rain pollution. And if the Congress enacts such a law to establish America's carbon market for cutting global warming pollution, then Congress will be able to set the terms on which other countries can participate. And that's an important first step in creating a framework that overall could greatly energize the international negotiations, which are already occurring, to extend Kyoto's $30 billion carbon market and make it much bigger in the future.
Yanni Petsonk with Environmental Defense. David Montgomery, do you think President Bush would sign that?
I would hesitate to predict what the president would sign, but I think the key to all of this is not an either or on emission trading. As far as domestic policy go, we have emission trading, which is favored by many who think that they would be able to participate in that market and do well out of it. Other approaches, such as carbon taxes, I think are generally favored by most of the economics community as more suited to the problem of global warming. But in any event, the issue is not whether we set up a system, but really at what level we set it up. Would it be something like the Bingaman proposal, which is
I'm going to ask you to hold on for a moment because the music indicates we need to go to a break. We will do that, come back, let you finish your point and continue this conversation on Reporter's Notebook, Celebrities, Murder Charges, and Money in the Courtrooms of Los Angeles. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Mormon Olney back with To the Point, talking today about global warming and the White House conference set up with the 16 highest polluting nations, with responsible for some 90% of the greenhouse gas emissions. We're talking about mandatory controls, about voluntary compliance, various treaties that currently exist, and what might happen in the future. Complicated area. David Montgomery, let me ask you to finish your point, Vice President in charge of the environment practice at CRA International. Go ahead.
Just to focus on the question of international emission trading, what was rarely realized is that there really are no advanced industrial countries who are interested in selling emission permits in this market. They all want to buy. The supply is coming from countries like Russia and Eastern Europe who have excess permits because of the collapse of their economies after the fall of communism, and a country, and in particular China, very few other countries, but China that has been supplying the credits that Annie was describing in the under the Clean Development Mechanism. Recently, there have been a number of press reports and good studies, for example, from Stanford University, questioning the quality of those credits and the incentives that or loopholes that the CDM has set up for essentially gaming the system by building new facilities to produce greenhouse gases and then being paid to destroy them. I think that, plus the size of the transfers of just wealth that would go from the industrial countries to other countries in order to buy into this trading system, I think make some policymakers, and I think make a lot of environmentalists uncomfortable about the extent to which you actually get real emission reductions when the trading involves hot air from Russia and kind of artificially destroyed fluorocarbons from China.
Andy Petzonk, back to you. Again, International Counsel at Environmental Defense, formerly with both the Bush and first Clinton administrations. What do you say about gaming the system and transferring more wealth than perhaps is justifiable?
First of all, let's talk about the emissions trading that's going on within the industrialized countries. I've been to Europe recently, and it's fascinating the innovations that this system is unleashing. Who is the largest producer of wind turbines in the world? Is it General Electric? No. Is it any other American company? No. It's Denmark. And the Danes are producing high-quality wind turbines, zero carbon-emitting energy source, and making money on it. And the emissions trading system in Europe is unleashing a cornucopia of innovation.
How does the trading system lead to Denmark's development of wind energy?
Well, it's really interesting, Warren, in a couple of ways. First, under the European system, the global warming pollution from about 12,000 different installations is capped. That's power plants, manufacturing facilities, and so on. And anyone who can come up with a better, cheaper, faster way of cutting global warming pollution can sell their technology into a market where there's great demand for those technologies, because the more you cut your global warming pollution, the more emissions allowances you have that you can save for the future or sell to someone else who hasn't found as creative or inexpensive ways of cutting pollution.
Well, what about China, which may already be polluting more than the United States does, and the possibility, as David Montgomery has outlined, of China gaming the system?
Well, the rules need to be tightened for the way in which China and other developing countries participate, and we, among other groups, have proposed some innovative ways to tighten those rules and expand the market. But the U.S. Congress can play a crucial role here, because when Congress caps America's greenhouse gas emissions, Congress will set up what may be the world's largest carbon trading market, and so Congress can determine the terms on which Chinese emission reduction credits can gain entry into our market. So Congress can require that foreign emissions credits have to prove up their bona fides and have to achieve more environmental benefit than the current system allows or the current system requires.
So, David Montgomery, can the Congress then deal with this problem and eliminate it to making the, or at least control it, making the cap and trade system work?
It's all a matter in that part, I think, of how, of a trade-off between seeing these international emission trading as a cost containment mechanism, that is something that can make it possible to meet U.S. caps at a lower cost, versus trying to make it something which does an extremely good job of making sure that there's no gaming that's possible. Neither way does it add up to the same thing that you would get if China were to accept an enforceable cap on its own emissions and had the economic and legal institutions to support that.
Annie Petzonk, you wouldn't disagree with that, would you, that it would be better to have China do it itself?
I'd absolutely agree with that, and I think that's part of the reason why in China there are very interesting experiments going on now at regional levels to try the cap-and-trade system as a means of learning how to reduce local air pollution, which, as many recent press reports have indicated, is a horrendous problem in China. And by experimenting with cap-and-trade for these local systems and regional systems, the Chinese are learning a great deal about exactly what David described, the need for transparent emissions reporting and effective compliance and enforcement tools. Those are useful things in any environmental compliance system. They make law work better, more fairly, and more effectively.
Okay, let's go back to the conference that's going on now in Washington. Our final guest for this segment of our program is Scott Siegel. He's a Washington attorney that represents the utilities industries, one industry, of course, that is extraordinarily involved in all of this and very, very, very interested, deeply involved, let me say, and extraordinarily interested. Scott Siegel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We heard earlier that Condoleezza Rice, in opening this session, talked a lot about technology as the way to deal with the oil economy, which she said was not sustainable. What do you expect to come out of this conference having to do with technology, and what sorts of technological fixes do you think we can expect in the future?
Well, the one area of common ground that we entered today's meeting with was that technology is really the key to solving global climate change difficulties, to reducing carbon, creating alternative mechanisms for generation of electricity, or for capturing emissions and creating, for example, new transportation mechanisms and the like. The problem with a cap approach or a carbon tax approach is they tend to lead to what are called avoidance behaviors. People seek out loopholes, or perhaps they even transfer manufacturing assets overseas to establish themselves in areas that aren't likely to enforce, as David Montgomery was talking about, aren't likely to have the same kind of notions of enforcement. So a program which would incentivize technological innovation in the United States, a program that would then attempt to diffuse that technology through foreign technology promotion, targeted development assistance, working with the Exim Bank and the World Bank, working with the United Nations itself to make sure that this innovative carbon-reducing technology has the widest aperture, may have the best chance for actually achieving success at controlling carbon. One point. It's often been said that if you adopt a cap on one day, the next day you'll have 1,000 lawyers show up and tell you why their industry isn't under the cap or why it would be better to invest elsewhere. If you adopt a package of technological incentives, you'll have 1,000 entrepreneurs show up the next day trying to get the money. So there's a very real sense in which you reverse some of the perverse disincentives to control overseas if we have a more of an incentives-based approach. Should that kind of approach not work? Should that kind of approach not be able to be benchmarked and to show actual declines in carbon? Well, then the United States and other nations are always free to adopt either a cap approach or a carbon tax approach, whatever makes sense given the exigencies of their national economy. So what will come out of this discussion? I think a robust discussion of technology promotion programs, which I think are really much more consistent with solving the problem on the ground.
What about the question of time in dealing with climate change? Already we are seeing the consequences of it in the melting of the polar ice cap. There's concern about the rising of sea levels and so on and so forth. Scott Siegel, is it necessary to sort of try to do everything all at once, develop new technologies and control emissions all at the same time in order to try to get make some kind of influence on this?
Well, I think that we're at a period of rare emerging political consensus, and it is the time to begin to select among our policy options and articulate a path forward on climate change. Now, here's where my position may differ with some, for example, in the environmentalist community. My view of it is, initially what we ought to do is try incentive-based approaches which get technology to market as soon as possible, can be fine-tuned and targeted to the most promising technologies with the best chance of adoption both here and overseas. We should benchmark, register those emissions, understand if we're having emissions reductions and reductions in the rate of not only of emissions but the intensity of the production processes that still are underway in the United States. Then, and only then, if it appears that benchmarks, reasonable benchmarks, are not being met, should we break the glass and go to a more of an old-style cap program or an even older style tax program. Listen, a lot of comparisons are made between the cap and trade program that exists in the current Clean Air Act, which is for sulfur dioxide, and what we could look forward to with respect to carbon dioxide. I want to make it very clear, it is not as simple as merely scaling up the sulfur dioxide program, or the acid rain program as it's sometimes called, in the existing Clean Air Act. For one thing, many, many more sources emit carbon dioxide than emit sulfur dioxide. And further, even back in 1990, when we structured the acid rain program, we were largely requiring off-the-shelf technology. That is not true for carbon dioxide. We either have to fuel switch or rely on technology which is not yet developed.
Again, Scott Siegel is Washington attorney who represents the utility industry. Let me go back to Juliet Eilprin, our national environmental reporter with the Washington Post. We're getting into some nitty-gritty here, some details that I think may be hard for people to assimilate. Everybody hasn't made sense, but let me ask you to sort of put this in context, in terms again of this issue of time. And as these debates go on, what are we facing in that context?
Basically, we have one key deadline, which is why everyone keeps talking about the Bali negotiations. The real deadline is actually in late 2009. That will be the next round of negotiations after this one. It'll take place in Denmark, and that'll be critical because everyone agrees, no matter what political persuasion they come from, that that's the moment where you need to put in place whatever system will take the place of the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012. Now, obviously, 2009 is also an interesting date because at that point you'll have a new administration in the White House, and I think everyone, again, regardless of ideology, thinks that could be very significant because you could easily have an administration more open to the idea of both imposing a mandatory carbon cap in the U.S. and joining a mandatory binding international commitment on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. So essentially, people are scrambling this year to lay the foundation for negotiations, which absolutely have to produce a concrete result by the end of 2009, basically December of 2009. And if they fail to do that, the international carbon market, trading market that Annie Petzong has been talking about may collapse. Just a number of the institutions that have been growing in anticipation of a strict carbon cap regime could fall apart.
David Montgomery, back to you with CRA International. Would that be okay with you?
I think that the highest priority in all of these negotiations is to find a way to deal with technology and a way to deal with the problems of bringing developing countries in. I think that takes a new approach. I would hate to see institutions that are capable of helping us move forward fall apart, but I definitely do not think that commitment of the U.S. to mandatory caps is either necessary or even particularly helpful in getting at the issues of bringing developing countries in and develop and bringing in technology. Those need to be focused on directly, and I think outside negotiations over mandatory caps.
Annie Petzok with Environmental Defense. A moment ago, Scott Siegel said this is a rare moment where there is an emerging political consensus. Do you agree with that? It sounds like on this program that perhaps you could argue that's not happening.
Well, I'm not sure where Scott's been residing for the past several years, but the emerging political consensus is occurring on Capitol Hill, and that is heading toward mandatory caps on emissions for the United States, establishing a carbon market that invites and challenges developing countries to step up to the plate and participate, and that through the market energizes new technologies and gets them out there at lower cost, faster, better, cheaper. I will say one other thing. Scott did urge a kind of voluntary approach with technology incentives and kind of benchmarking so that companies can see how well they're doing in reducing emissions on a voluntary basis. We've had that precise program in America since 1990. It was reaffirmed by President Bush on February 14th, 2002. The voluntary approach has not worked. America's emissions since 1990 have continued to climb. other countries are seeing the power of the carbon market, and our Congress is starting to see that too.
So, Scott Siegel, is that what you meant by the political consensus or something else?
Well, despite the vituperation you just heard, the fact of the matter is the emerged consensus I'm talking about is the same one Annie's talking about. There is interest in Congress in adopting legislation. The only intriguing question that remains is what type of legislation are we talking about? Are we talking about an immediate cap and trade program, which begins to merge into almost an old-style command and control regulation? Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about something which sees what we can get out of technology promotion first? This notion that we've had a stem-to-stern technology promotion program in place since 1990 is completely misleading and incorrect. That is not true.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt you simply in the interest of time and just go back very quickly to Juliet Alperin with The Washington Post. Let me ask again this question of do we know how fast the impact of global warming is occurring? And is there any way to measure progress in dealing with the emission of greenhouse gases in terms of how long it'll take to make a difference?
Sure. No, that's an excellent question, and I'd give you a couple timetables. One is that most people, and one of the top UN envoys mentioned this morning, most people believe that we can let emissions rise until 2020, and at that point they need to start falling. And the timetable for that is set by what scientists have said is the maximum acceptable level of climate change. Basically, they're concerned that if we have more than a 3.6 degree Fahrenheit increase in the temperature globally, that will start to have huge ramifications on the climate and on our Earth. So I think people feel like you have to have in place serious cuts that will start being meaningful, and generally the benchmark they give is by 2020 things have to be falling, and scientists generally say that you need a reduction by 2050 that's roughly 80% cut of what we have now, or sorry, a 50% cut of what we have now. So those are between 50 and 80 is kind of what's on the table.
Just in case anybody thinks this is not an urgent matter that needs the kind of attention that we've given it today, and I want to thank you all for being with us. Juliet Alperin, once again, at the Washington Post. Her book, incidentally, Fight Club Politics, How Partisanship is Poisoning the House of Representatives. David Montgomery at CRA International, a global business, economics, and finance consulting firm. Annie Petzonk with Environmental Defense, formerly with the first Bush and Clinton administrations, and Scott Siegel, Washington attorney who represents the utility industries. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks,
Warren.
In Los Angeles, almost 90% of murder charges lead to convictions, but O.J. Simpson and actor Robert Blake were both acquitted of killing their wives. Yesterday, the judge declared a mistrial in the case of the music producer Phil Spector, accused of killing an aspiring actress. The Los Angeles district attorney says he will file new charges, but for the moment, Spector is the latest in a string of high-profile murder defendants who have beaten the odds. In a moment, more on celebrities, the justice system, and money on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Popoto's Notebook on To the Point. At 67, Phil Spector is no longer well-known, but in the 60s and 70s, he made a fortune as a music producer for groups including the Beatles, Ike and Tina Turner, the Crystals, and the Ramones. 4 years ago, actress Lana Clarkson was shot to death in Spector's mansion in a Los Angeles suburb. One witness quoted him as saying, "I think I killed somebody." But yesterday, the jury split 10-2 for conviction. Inspector's second-degree murder trial has to be unanimous, and the judge declared a mistrial. Henry Weinstein is a legal affairs writer for the Los Angeles Times. And, Henry, good to have you with us.
Always good to be with you, Warren.
You go all the way back to the O.J. Simpson trial.
I should only see... should be so young to only go back that far.
You go back at least as far as the O.J. Simpson trial. Once again, we've had the Robert Blake trial and now the Spector trial, all cases where there seemed to be a heap of evidence against these very well-known people, and yet the juries went the other way. Is there something about celebrity trials in Los Angeles and juries in Los Angeles that has to do with this?
Well, I think the first thing we should do is to differentiate at least some between O.J. Simpson and the other two people who, by the time they went to trial, were not nearly as well known as Simpson was, and he was clearly a national icon and a sports hero, and, you know, a guy that was seen leaping over turnstiles, racing for his Hertz car at the time he was on trial. I think the big factor more than, and several people I talked to yesterday said they think the big factor is not merely celebrity but money. And what I mean by that is that all three of these people, and certainly including Mr. Spector, who had a lot of money from his great success as a record producer, were able to hire a lot of people to mount a formidable defense. Spector had seven lawyers. He had some very good forensics people. He had a number of private investigators to look into the background of the woman who died. All of that added up to his team being able to raise a lot of theories. And although they didn't persuade the majority of jurors, or even close to a majority, they persuaded two, and that was enough to get him a retrial. To get him a hung jury, which now he'll have to have another trial.
Again, the DA does intend to retry this, so we will have to go through it again. But you said he has seven attorneys. He even turned down some fairly important attorneys, and some attorneys, after taking a look at the case, walked away.
Right. I mean, I think that people thought, I mean, some people, well, some of those, we don't know because they haven't told us exactly the reasons why they left the case. I mean, it might have been just over some personal disagreements over, you know, how the case would be handled. I mean, I think a lot of people thought at the start of the case that the idea that a woman who met a man for the first time and went over to his house and then wound up, killing herself, which was the theory that, you know, was being advocated by the defense, that it was either a suicide or some sort of an accident. I think some people just found that implausible. But clearly some people on the jury thought that perhaps she had, killed herself, or that there'd been some kind of an accident. You have to remember the only people that were there at the time were Spector and the woman, Lana Clarkson, who died. And some people felt like that the prosecutors hadn't felt put the gun in Spector's hand, they said. And in addition to that, some of the jurors said that they thought that the prosecution, which was generally credited with doing a fine job in this case, should have presented a psychological profile of Clarkson to counter the contentions of the defense, which made two assertions that she relating to the possibility that she might have killed herself. One was that her career had totally gone south, and the second thing was evidence presented by forensics specialists that the overwhelming percentage of people who die from a gunshot wound in the mouth have taken their own lives. So I suspect that when this case is retried, that at least the DA's office would do two things differently. One would be to present a psychological profile of Clarkson, and I think the other thing is that they will sort of try to widen the focus of their presentation so that the jury would have the opportunity to convict not just on second-degree murder but on involuntary manslaughter, which would be a lot easier to get a conviction on.
The prosecution did, of course, present witnesses who suggested that having women over to his house and threatening them with guns was a pattern in Phil Spector's behavior. But it seems to me what's really important here is the instruction to the jury that they have to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And you're suggesting that the more resources the defense has, the more witnesses they can come up with, the more questions they can raise, the more likely it is that they can shake that conviction on the jury's department, the jury's part, that there is no reasonable doubt.
Well, I think that that's true. That is the standard in all criminal trials in this case. The question of what is a reasonable doubt is clearly, you know, something that can be different for different people. I mean, there is something that when jurors ask about that, they're told that it doesn't mean that you can't have any doubt. It just means that you can't have any reasonable doubt, and that can be different for different people. I think the other thing that should be emphasized is that these cases, I mean, the three that you've mentioned, O.J., Robert Blake, and Spector, are all, in one respect, an aberration from the vast bulk of what goes on in the criminal justice system. I mean, first of all, the overwhelming bulk of people plead guilty when they're charged with crimes. There's only a small percentage of these cases that go to trial, and even then, a lot of the people that go to trial are indigent. They're represented by public defenders, and Los Angeles has an excellent public defender's office. However, public defender offices don't have the ability to automatically go out and hire 3 or 5 or 6 forensic specialists and a number of private investigators. They have some people on staff, but I mean, a defense normally can't be mounted with this amount of resources, and oftentimes public defenders will go into court and, you know, plead for more resources, and they often don't get them.
Very quickly, because we're running short of time, the LAPD took a big hit as a result of the O.J. Simpson trial. Was sloppy police work ever suggested in this case?
No, it really wasn't. I think most everyone that I talked to who was at the trial regularly said the prosecution did a good job. There was certainly no instance here where, you know, there was a question of, you know, stolen evidence or misplaced evidence or blood evidence left in without refrigeration. I think it was very, very different in that respect.
And it was the county sheriff, not the LAPD, that
right,
handled
yes, it. Right, but there was no suggestion that this was, you know, badly done in that way at all.
Okay. Celebrity justice and money in Los Angeles. Once again, 90% of the murder cases result in a very different outcome from this one. Henry Weinstein with the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Vanessa Romo with Karen Radziner and Andrea Brody. Our technical director, Phoebe Zimmerman. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.